This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Rachel Letterman about two settlements involving the Oakland Police Department.
The Oakland Police Department and the city of Oakland seem to never learn. Consent decrees, suit after suit. But hopefully, finally, they're getting the message. No more mass arrests and violence against protesters.
We'll talk with Professor Al McCoy about the making of the U.S. surveillance state.
If you think what the NSA is doing came out of nowhere, you're wrong. The mass surveillance state, known as America, is blowback from as early as our war in the Philippines in 1898.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the Bradley Manning trial is continuing. There have been some motions. What's the latest update?
Recently, the defense presented its case and then rested. The defense then made arguments as to why certain of the charges ought to be dismissed. The main charge the defense focused on is the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 104, which we've talked about here before. It's the aiding the enemy charge. It's the most serious charge against Bradley Manning. It's the one that potentially carries a death penalty, but the government said it won't ask for the death penalty, but it also carries a life sentence without parole. So it's really serious. The government charged Bradley Manning with it, and the defense made a motion to dismiss, claiming that the government hadn't proven its case. The judge hasn't decided that yet. The government has a rebuttal case to put on, and perhaps the judge will decide it very shortly as to whether that charge will go forward or whether she'll dismiss it now or whether she'll decide on the guilt or innocence under that charge at a later time. My opening thought about this is the charge is ridiculous and absurd. And to me, it's outrageous that the government charged aiding the enemy. And when you look at the evidence that was summarized by defense counsel David Coombs, it becomes even sillier. They just don't have the evidence. Let's see if we can understand the charge. The charge, and I can read it from the charge sheet, is that, and this is what the government has to prove, the government has to prove actual knowledge by PFC, Private First Class Manning, that by giving the intelligence, the documents, et cetera, to WikiLeaks, which happens to be my client as a disclosure to everybody, the centers and my client, the judges determined that for the government to prove the aiding the enemy charge against Bradley Manning, it must show that Bradley Manning had, quote, actual knowledge that by giving the intelligence to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks, who is the client of my own as well as the Center for Constitutional Rights, that by doing so, he was actually giving intelligence to the enemy through this indirect means of WikiLeaks. And the enemy in this case was defined as Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. So the rule is that the judge decided was that Bradley Manning had to have actual knowledge that WikiLeaks would somehow transmit or that the enemy would read the documents on the WikiLeaks website. The proof was thin, to put it mildly. When I reread the government's position as well as the defense counsel, the government tried to argue that a 2008 government report on WikiLeaks that Bradley Manning supposedly read gave him the information that documents given to WikiLeaks would be read by Al-Qaeda. So the government argues that this 2008 study of WikiLeaks, written by Army Counterintelligence Center, called WikiLeaks Organization, an online reference to foreign intelligence services, insurgents, or terrorist groups, was enough for Bradley Manning to know that WikiLeaks materials would be read by enemies of the United States. And that's what they depend on. David Coombs just tore them to shreds. That's Bradley Manning's defense counsel. He read parts of it, the judgment section, for example. Everything was with the question mark. It said that WikiLeaks documents could be used, that the question was, will they be used by terrorist groups? So it's all hypothetical, the entire 2008 report. Yet that's the report the government is depending on to say that Bradley Manning had actual knowledge. So I think, apart from whether the charge was right, whether actual knowledge is sufficient, The fact is, there was no way that just because Bradley Manning read that 2008 report about WikiLeaks being, quote, a terrorist organization with a question mark, something that's read by Al-Qaeda, there's no way that that's actual knowledge by Bradley Manning. And so I think that the charge will or should be dismissed. It's clear he needed, under the judge's charge, at least actual knowledge. The other thing that's interesting about this, as maybe many of our listeners know, that the government dragged into court, at least at this point, a stipulation that bin Laden had requested documents that WikiLeaks had put up on its website, and they supposedly found those documents, or at least the request, on the computer of bin Laden. But of course, that's after the fact. They probably found New York Times articles on there as well. So that doesn't really tell us anything. But what was really interesting that came out is defense counsel argued, and he had evidence for it, he argued that bin Laden never requested any WikiLeaks documents or didn't try and get them until after the documents are released, and then the U.S. starts claiming that WikiLeaks is aiding the enemy and is helping out Al-Qaeda, etc., and is a terrorist organization. Only when the U.S. brings up the fact that, whoa, this is really hurting us, bin Laden says apparently to himself, well, if the U.S. says this guy is a terrorist or WikiLeaks is terrorism and they're trying to, and they're aiding the enemy, which is us, maybe I should get a hold of these documents. And then there's evidence by a professor at Harvard who testifies for the defense, Yochai Benkler, who's a professor at Harvard, and he gave incredibly powerful testimony. And you can read it. The transcript is out on the Freedom of the Press Foundation's website. They have the transcripts. And he says that up until the documents came out 2010, almost everyone looked at WikiLeaks as a legitimate journalism organization. And only after the documents came out and were shown to be embarrassing to the United States did the U.S. and the media start to label what everybody up till then considered to be a legitimate journalist organization, to be a terrorist organization, to be an aiding the enemy organization, etc. So going back to this charge, the charge that Bradley Manning had actual knowledge that Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula would read the documents, there's absolutely, really no evidence at all. I just want to step back from that in one second, because that's the way the charge is right now. He had to have actual knowledge. In my view, and I think the view of many lawyers, that wouldn't even be enough. Even if he had actual knowledge that Al-Qaeda was going to read documents up on WikiLeaks, and Heidi's nodding.
Well, I wanted to ask, Michael, doesn't there have to be a proven harm? If there was knowledge, there doesn't have to be any nexus that something happened.
There doesn't have to be harm. No, there doesn't have to be harm. But let's say he had actual knowledge that they would read them.
Right.
You know, when the New York Times publishes the warrantless wiretapping story, you know, the chances are maybe that's not actual knowledge, but that the, quote, enemies of the United States are going to read that. Let's say Al-Qaeda announces, we read the New York Times every day. Should the New York Times not publish the warrantless wiretap story? Should WikiLeaks not publish documents about the United States? That's just ridiculous. And the reason it's ridiculous is actual knowledge, while that's what the government has to prove in the Bradley Manning case, I don't think that's a high enough standard for them. I think the standard is they have to prove that Bradley Manning had actual knowledge, plus he had to have the intent to aid the enemy. That had to be his purpose. Bradley Manning goes on for pages that his intent had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or aiding the enemy.
He wanted to educate the public.
He wanted to educate the public, get debate about this issue, much like Snowden has now said, and that's why he did it. So I think even the standard of actual knowledge, which the government has not met in the Bradley Manning case, will not be sufficient under what the law should be, which is the intent. Otherwise, every newspaper who knows that it's read by the, quote, enemy will be the indirect means by which people transmit secrets to the enemy, or not even secrets, information, and can get any whistleblower the death penalty. Doesn't make any sense at all. So I'm convinced that the judge will dismiss this charge. But, you know, things never necessarily go the way I think they ought to go from a legal point of view or even from a moral point of view. Let's see what happens.
What do you think the time frame is going to be on all of this? Could it drag on for a few months?
The trial is going much faster. The government's case took couple weeks less than it should have. Defense case was much shorter. Bradley Manning did not testify. The judge has allowed a very narrow rebuttal argument, which is when the government comes back after the defense case and puts on a couple more people to try and distinguish away new information that they didn't expect in the original case. Then there'll be summations. Whether they'll take more than a day, I can't say. Then I don't know if she'll take some time before she decides the case. Likely. And then they go right from the decision on the...
to the sentencing.
Right from the decision,
right.
Assuming he's convicted, to the sentencing, and they do the mitigation immediately.
And mitigation, for our listeners, is presenting facts that go in his favor to hopefully result in a decreased sentence,
right,
a lesser
sentence.
Right,
like that he was tortured, yeah. Mm-hmm. That he did this for sincere reasons. End of July would be early, but it could happen by then. I encourage people, again, as we have on every time we've talked about Bradley Manning, to get yourselves to Fort Meade. It's not the easiest thing from New York, but from other places it might be easier. But you can get there. You can get into the courtroom. If you can't get in, you can get on and watch the video monitor. Bradley Manning needs and deserves all our support.
Since we recorded the show, we have two important updates. We spoke about the aiding the enemy charge against Bradley Manning, and we were awaiting the judge's decision on whether she would sustain that charge against Bradley Manning. That's the most serious charge, possible carrying life imprisonment for Bradley Manning. Sadly and unfortunately, and to me shockingly, the judge upheld the charge against Bradley Manning of aiding the enemy. I thought there was no evidence at all that he had actual knowledge that documents he was giving to WikiLeaks would go to, quote, the enemy. But the judge felt otherwise. I want to put the judge's decision in a quick context. It was on a motion to dismiss the charges, and in that case, the judge has a very low standard. She takes all of the evidence put in by the government as true. She doesn't take the defense evidence into consideration, and she has inferences favorable to the government that she draws. So it doesn't mean that she will necessarily convict Bradley Manning at the end of the trial, but it doesn't bode well. In my view, there was simply no evidence to say that Bradley Manning had actual knowledge that Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula would read these documents. In addition, and finally on this point, the judge ruled out that Bradley Manning had to have the specific intent to aid Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. I think that's required by the statute. She said it wasn't required. I think she'll be reversed on appeal if she upholds a conviction in this case, but that's a long time to wait. The deleterious effects already of a decision like that on both whistleblowing in the Army, as well as calling journalists and publishers like WikiLeaks, or for that matter, the New York Times and others, as an indirect way of aiding the enemy, tells us about the government's efforts to completely end any kind of transparency in this country, a serious blow to free speech, democracy, and informed citizens.
In recent weeks, attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild achieved two significant victories for the rights of protesters faced with police brutality and unlawful repression. The first came when the city of Oakland settled a class action lawsuit for over $1 million. The second victory occurred in early July, when Oakland City Council approved a settlement for $1.17 million in another lawsuit arising from police actions at protests. As part of these settlements, the Oakland Police Department is now legally obligated to follow a crowd control policy. This policy, which already existed but lacked enforcement, outlines limits on police department officers' use of force and the ability to make mass arrests in protest situations. Here to discuss the two cases is attorney Rachel Letterman. Welcome, Rachel, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
We're delighted to have really two wonderful successes coming out of the San Francisco Bay Area, two lawsuits one related to Occupy and one that occurred after the killing of Oscar Grant. Can you give us, before we go into the details of the settlements, brief summaries of each case?
Yes, sure. The first case has to do with demonstration that occurred on the day that Johannes Messerli was sentenced for the death of Oscar Grant. That's the BART officer who shot Oscar Grant in the back as he was restrained face down on the subway platform in the city of Oakland. There's a movie out about the last day in the life of Oscar Grant called Fruitvale Station that I would highly recommend seeing. It's playing all over the country now. The death of Oscar Grant sparked a number of large demonstrations. November 5th, 2010 was the date that Messerli was sentenced, and he was given a very minimal sentence for involuntary manslaughter of just 2 years, actually 11 months with time served. So there was a demonstration planned for that evening, and it was actually a relatively small demonstration and low-key compared to what had occurred more immediately after the murder. So basically what happened is that OPD had a prearranged plan to not allow a march after dark. There was a rally that was permitted in downtown Oakland, and then a number of people, a relatively small group, about 200, started marching in the general direction of Fruitvale BART, where the shooting had occurred. Pretty much as soon as the march started, the police began to set up for a mass arrest.
And when you say mass arrest, just for our listeners, that basically means an unlawful arrest of a group of individuals.
An arrest of multiple people together, but this was in fact an unlawful arrest. There was no lawful basis to arrest this group of demonstrators. They were simply having a perfectly legal protest march through the street. But the police immediately began moving into position to try to surround and stop the march, but all without making any announcements or giving any orders to the demonstrators. When a police line would be erected in front of the march, people would naturally turn another direction, and so this went on for a while where the march was simply rerouted by the police a number of times, but all without actually any attempt to communicate with the demonstrators or tell them what was going on. Eventually, OPD essentially herded 150 people into a residential area where they had never intended to go, where the streets were relatively narrow and the police were able to completely surround them. At this point, starting to get dark, police simply surround everybody within a block of 6th Avenue in Oakland, and keep them there for an extended time without making any announcements. And then there was very strange announcement given, because, you know, people in the Bay Area are used to having a lot of demonstrations, and there's a standard form for a dispersal order, an unlawful assembly announcement with a dispersal order, which usually is supposed to give people an opportunity to disperse and leave if they don't want to get arrested, even assuming that there was a basis to declare the march an unlawful assembly, which in this case there was not. So, but instead of what people were expecting to hear, the police announced, "This is a crime scene. You're all under arrest," basically. And they allowed media or some media to leave, but everyone else that had been trapped in that block was arrested, and even including a couple of neighborhood residents. As part of this, legal observer Dan Spalding was arrested.
And he's the named plaintiff in this case.
He became the lead plaintiff in the case that we subsequently filed. He and 149 other people were first left on the street for a long period of time, then loaded into sheriff's department buses, and then they were left on the buses for hours and hours. For some people, up to 6 hours on a bus handcuffed with those plastic zip tie type handcuffs, which can be very painful, behind their back, and not allowed out to use the bathroom or anything.
A couple of questions. When was Oscar Grant killed?
January 1st, 2009.
So this is actually about quite a bit later, right after that?
Yeah, this is at the conclusion of the criminal case against BART officer Messerly, who shot Oscar Grant. The settlement is in process right now, going through the class action settlement approval process, but we settled the case, I guess, in January.
Right, so this is Spalding v. City of Oakland, and these are the 150 protesters. Now, the second case, called Campbell v. City of Oakland, concerns the Occupy protests that a lot of us were aware of because we saw pictures of them in October and November 2011.
That's
now,
right.
What's interesting to me about this is you first have these mass arrests because of the killing and then the trial of the person who killed Oscar Grant and then the protests. And then even after you filed the lawsuit, the Oakland police are continuing to do the same things they did before. Is that right? I mean, they didn't change after your lawsuit.
Well, yeah, and you have to look at this in the overall context, which is that the Oakland Police Department has been under a federal consent decree since January of 2003, mandating a reform process, pretty basic reform process such as other police departments have been able to successfully implement in other cities, with an independent monitor monitoring their progress. But OPD has, up to this point, been unable to fully comply with that consent decree. That consent decree went into effect in January of 2003. Then in March 2003, the U.S. started bombing Iraq, and there was a demonstration at the Port of Oakland, April 7th, 2003, which was called in the New York Times the most violent police response to an anti-war demonstration in the entire country, because OPD simply shot more than 60 demonstrators and some longshoremen who were standing by waiting to see if they should go to work with various types of less lethal munitions. So there was a lawsuit about that, which was brought jointly by the Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, and Jim Channon and John Burris, who are the plaintiff's attorneys in the Riders case that resulted in the consent decree negotiated settlement agreement over OPD. And as a result of that case, we settled the injunction claims in that case with a negotiated crowd control policy, because the Riders consent decree didn't address crowd control at all. It addresses more police accountability and use of force issues. Over a 9-month period, we negotiated a comprehensive crowd control policy for OPD, which is a model policy which addresses a lot of crowd control and demonstration contingencies, and it bans certain types of less lethal weapons, and it provides very strict limitations on use of chemical agents and less lethal weapons in demonstrations and other crowd events, and it specifies the criteria and process that should be used to declare an unlawful assembly and make a mass arrest if that's warranted, including giving notice and opportunity to disperse.
Rachel, I have a question. What makes you think this is going to be any different from the last 10 years where there was a consent decree? What's changed in terms of, has city leadership changed? Has the police department chief changed? Is public pressure such that you think there's a hope that they will conform to these guidelines?
Well, we always have a hope. So what I'm saying is that we've had this crowd control policy in place, but basically every single provision of the crowd control policy was violated in the Occupy Oakland incidents and the Oscar Grant incident. So that's a big part of why we filed the two lawsuits. The Spalding case focuses on the unlawful mass arrest and the incarceration. And the Campbell case, which is the Occupy Oakland case, focused on the use of force and the use of chemical agents and less lethal munitions. So we brought those cases in part to try to enforce the crowd control policy. So a lot has changed just in the, over the last 6 months or so, because in significant part as a result of the fiasco of OPD's response to Occupy Oakland. Jim Channon and John Burris brought a motion for federal receivership of OPD, and that was resolved with somewhat of a compromise in which the federal court appointed what they're calling a compliance director, who is not a full receiver but has most of the powers of a federal receiver over the department. So that person, whose name is Tom Frazier, who happens to be the same person who wrote a very scathing independent investigation report regarding the October 25th, 2011 Occupy Oakland event, the police response to it. So,
well, you know, that sounds good. I mean, you know, I'm looking at it all, Rachel. You know, you had, I remember in whatever the year was when Jerry Brown was, what was he? Was he mayor of Oakland at some point? Is that right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, and those, we have all those pictures of the protesters at the docks being shot with wooden pellets and their cheeks right. being exploded. Then you have consent decrees. Then you have another, the woman who, I guess, did the Occupy protest, the mayor, she was considered liberal.
Mayor Kwan.
Right. In fact, we had some liberal friends as lawyers working for her at one time, as I recall. And then she goes and does Occupy, the Occupy protests, apart from the Grant protests. And so I guess, yeah, the receiver is probably, you know, ultimately maybe at least one hope.
Yeah, I mean,
it looks intractable, the place.
We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there's also been a complete shakeup of command. There's a new chief who's an acting chief. There's also a search going on for a chief. So we think those changes are very favorable, but we don't just because of the long history of being unable to comply with federal orders or even their own policies, we're just taking a wait-and-see approach. But in terms of the crowd control policy, the settlements in these two cases mandates, again, that OPD follow the crowd control policy, and more importantly, it gives the federal court continuing jurisdiction to enforce that for a 4 to 7 year period starting now, so that we can get some help from the court if we need to, rather than continuously having to file these lawsuits, because it's not really what we want to continue suing the city and costing the taxpayers more and more public money due to this police misconduct. But there hasn't been the will on the part of the Oakland City leadership to get the police under control. So we're doing the best we can, thinking of anything we can that could try to force them to comply with the Constitution and their own policies and basic law.
U.S. District Court Judge Thelton Henderson was one of the judges. Who was the other judge?
The judge in the Campbell case is actually Judge Tiger.
Rachel, I know you were involved years ago after the LAPD officers were acquitted in the beating of Rodney King and the San Francisco Police Department swept the Mission District, unlawfully arresting more than 300 people. Then you brought a lawsuit and obtained a $1 million settlement after 5 years of litigation in the case Collins v. Jordan. It was found that the government cannot suspend fundamental rights to freedom of speech and assembly just because there are volatile or even previous demonstrations that have been associated with violence or property damage. And that case was very important in changing the San Francisco Police Department's practices toward demonstrations.
Demonstrations occurred as a result of that, and in San Francisco, the mayor decided to declare a state of emergency as a way to quell civil unrest, and as a result, about 350 people were arrested. The whole Mission District of San Francisco was swept. We did a lawsuit about that called Collins v. Jordan, which did result in that Ninth Circuit decision, which states, among other things, that a local emergency declaration does not suspend the Constitution.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on these significant victories, and we will be watching the Oakland Police Department in the days to come.
Thank you again, Rachel.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. and my sleeping here was broken. But my dream, it lingered near, in the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is showered. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
In a recent important article, Surveillance Blowback, The Making of the U.S. Surveillance State, 1898 to 2020, Professor Alfred McCoy brings us up to date on how and why we are facing the most massive surveillance state in the history of our country. This critical article helps us understand the context of the leaked NSA documents by whistleblower Ed Snowden. Professor McCoy details the surveillance timeline, beginning with the U.S. occupation of the Philippines in 1898, and makes the connection to U.S. imperialism abroad and the blowback that imperialism and surveillance state abroad has on our own lives here in the United States. We've had Professor McCoy on this show before, particularly around torture. His important work, The Question of Torture, was perhaps the best book on the Bush's administration and later Obama's administration involvement in torture.
Professor McCoy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
For many Americans, the recent Snowden revelations about spying came as a surprise, but you've been involved in chronicling really a timeline of U.S. spying starting back in 1898. Can you talk a bit about our occupation of the Philippines and what happened?
Sure. First of all, 4 years ago, I published a book called Policing America's Empire, which started in the Philippines and traced the history of U.S. domestic surveillance through what I call surveillance blowback. And writing publicly in 2009, I said the country was just a few tweaks away through this process of sort of surveillance blowback from our foreign operations, from establishing a domestic surveillance state.
You requote that in this article, and it's an incredible quote. I put a big star by it. And what you say exactly is, the war on terror has, quote, proven remarkably effective in building a technological template that could be just a few tweaks away from creating a domestic surveillance state, dash, dash, with omnipresent cameras, deep data mining, nanosecond biometric identification, and drone aircraft patrolling the homeland. You said that 4 years ago. I just want to emphasize your Cassandra-like nature.
Yeah, I know. It's the trajectory of history that allows you to see this. Whereas when you study history, you can't see the fine-grained details, but the overarching trends do emerge. And let me explain what happened, okay? In the late 19th century, America had what I call our first information regime, which was really a brilliant synergy of discoveries. Thomas Edison's quadruplex telegraph, Philo Remington's typewriter, allowed the transmission around the world and across the United States of data absolutely accurately at the rate of 40 words a minute. In the state of Massachusetts, Melville Dewey, an obscure librarian at Amherst College, invented something called the Dewey Decimal System, but what it was he discovered the smart number, the alphanumeric code that not only put things in order like 1, 2, 3, 4, but also indicated content. And this allowed potentially the filing of limitless amounts of data and, of course, the cross-filing, something you have to do for any kind of effective surveillance and following of human beings. And finally, in 1889, an engineer named Herman Hollerith invented the punch card, and he also invented the electric tabulating machine. And in 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau used the machine to enumerate 62 million Americans in the matter of weeks, which stunned the nation
and led to the founding of the International Business Machines Corporation, known as IBM.
Yeah, I read the article where you summarized these. Yeah, I thought that last fact was the most astounding. Who would have ever imagined in the 1890s that with a punch card system they could process 62 million Americans?
It was done in weeks. It was amazing. And it wasn't just counting them. It was enumerating all the data on those punch card census forms. But although the United States had, if you will, all the technological components of a surveillance state, the last thing we had, of course, was we had something, the Gainwell Corporation for a half century during the 19th century was the world leader in the development of police telegraph and telephone communications, those police boxes that used to be on the streets of every American city. Gainwell Corporation had 900 of these systems in operation across the United States, and collectively they sent 41 million messages in the year 1900. Well, we had all that potential, but the federal government was, in the United States, an extraordinarily weak apparatus. It effectively had, as of our intervention in the Philippines in 1898, the U.S. federal government had no domestic law enforcement or internal security capacity really much beyond the customs barrier, all right? And so when we intervened in the Philippines, we were suddenly faced with this massive insurgency, this guerrilla underground, and we smashed the regular military formations, but we couldn't break the insurgency. And so the U.S. Army, in order to pacify that country, created the first field intelligence unit in its 100-year history. And it appointed an obscure medical doctor named Captain Ralph Van Diemen to be the head of the Division of Military Information. It turned out he had a natural flair for intelligence, and he decided that he would map the entire Filipino political elite. And he developed information cards documenting physical appearance, real property, kinship relations, political affiliations, place of residence, an amazing amount of information. William Howard Taft, later President of the United States, passed very draconian sedition and libel legislation and created a powerful colonial secret police called the Philippines Constabulary. And together he had, for the day, a near total control over information. And what he developed was a system for suppressing scandal about allies and releasing incriminating information about political enemies.
This was all in the Philippines?
This was all in the Philippines, and this combination of this system, the U.S. Army Division of Military Information under Captain Van Diemen and William Howard Taft's combination of repressive, almost draconian legislation, and this colonial secret police pacified the Philippines.
This is early 1900s, right?
Between 1898 and 1907, when the operation was finally over. It took about 10 years to accomplish. Because the Philippines had the first national revolution in Asia. They had fielded an army. They defeated Spanish colonial rule when we intervened. So we had to undo that, not only defeat the army and track down the guerrillas. We had to track down the politicians. We had to penetrate them. We had to manipulate them. We had to politically demobilize a mobilized society. A society that launched Asia's first national revolution. Okay, well, 10 years after that process was completed in 1917, World War One, the United States joined World War One. At the time we entered the war in April of 1917, the United States had the only army on either side of the battlefield that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. We had no U.S. military intelligence. So we turned to now Colonel Van Diemen, who applied his Philippine experience to developing a very elaborate counterintelligence apparatus inside the United States. He's now known as the father of U.S. military intelligence, and he established something called the Military Intelligence Division, and he amplified his power. He started off with one employee himself. He had, by the end of the war, 1,700 employees, but more importantly, he formed an alliance with something called the American Protective League, which was an empowered series of vigilantes that carried badges, and they did domestic gumshoe surveillance. And through this, they compiled, my estimate is something like 1 million pages of type reports, mainly on German and Italian Americans, because those were our enemies in the war, and I was worried about sort of fifth column subversion in the United States. And then after the war, Van Diemen's Military Intelligence Division joined with the FBI, all right, and they launched a campaign against the left, the famous or notorious Luster raids in New York City, the Palmer raids across northeastern part of the United States, and counterintelligence operations against the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, all the way from New York City to Seattle. And the second thing that happened, which is very important, is that This was all done by an American Democratic liberal, that great American liberal president, Woodrow Wilson. Well, when the Republicans came into office in 1921, they were at that day all conservative privacy advocates. So the U.S. Attorney General, Harlan Fiske Stone, denounced what he called the dangers of a secret police. He forced the FBI to cut back all its ties to these patriotic vigilante organizations. And 5 years later, the Republican Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, abolished the cipher section of the Military Intelligence Division with his famous statement, "Gentlemen do not read each other's mail." And they ratcheted it right back. But nonetheless, the apparatus remained in place. And during the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, the FBI launched the notorious counterintelligence program using these same techniques that Van Diemen had developed during World War I in collaboration with the FBI. And they unleashed them on the African-American civil rights movement and on the anti-Vietnam protest movement and launched something like 2,300 dangerous and potentially violent counterintelligence operations under the COINTEL program against the anti-war left. And this whole thing came into public view in the mid-1970s. Seymour Hersh, then reporting for the New York Times, discovered that the CIA, violating its charter, was conducting domestic surveillance of the anti-war movement. The Church Committee began investigating, and the upshot of this all was, in a cruel irony, in 1978, President Carter created the FISA courts, which required the FISA court issue a warrant for wiretapping or surveillance, and thus bring to an end the illegal surveillance done by both CIA and FBI during the 60s and early 1970s.
We're talking about military intelligence spying on individuals. Doesn't that run counter to the Army should not be spying on civilians?
Yeah, but under the pressures of World War I, nobody raised that issue. You know, the Van Diemen's, you know, the U.S. Army, of course, as we all know, was fighting the Western Front in Europe, right? There were no combat operations in the United States. So Van Diemen's entire military intelligence division was, in fact, a domestic counterintelligence operation. There was no apparent concern. That was, I think, that sense that the military should stay out of domestic affairs, but more importantly, that privacy should be protected.
Let me go back for a second on that.
Sure.
You go from setting up of the whole operation during World War I under Wilson, et cetera, coming back to the United States at the same time and the work with the Protective League. And then the Republicans take office and they begin to roll it back. And then you go to Vietnam. And I know in your piece, of course, you talk about some of what happened in the interim, the anti-communist days, that was Hoover. So there's something going on here that in between the rollback from Wilson and then COINTELPRO. And can you just talk about that for a minute?
Well, sure. There are two things that happened. First of all, during the interwar period, really during the 1930s, the federal government had a very limited domestic surveillance. The FBI mainly concentrated during that period on being gangbusters, going after Pretty Boy Floyd and the bank robbers and all that sort of stuff. They focused the Bureau's resources on fighting, not so much mafia, but the spectacular kind of banditti, the independent bank robbers. And they stayed pretty much out of the domestic security and intelligence game because they've been cut back during the 1920s. During that period, when Van Diemen retired from the U.S. military with the rank of Major General in 1929, he moved into a comfortable bungalow with his wife, who was quite a formidable woman. She was the first woman in the world to fly on an aircraft. And together, retired General and Mrs. Van Diemen ran a kind of private intelligence service that had Army file clerks and regular FBI liaison officers dropping by. And from their home, they compiled files on 250,000 suspected subversives. And they ran a kind of informal intelligence exchange between the Office of Naval Intelligence, U.S. Army Military Intelligence Division, and then the notorious Red Squads in the San Diego and the Los Angeles Police. And the Los Angeles Police Red Squad was absolutely notorious in the 1930s for its abuse of due process and of civil liberties, and they descended actually into shakedowns and assassination attempts on each other that finally led to their abolition. And then the Better Business Bureaus in Los Angeles and cities across the United States also had their own anti-red intelligence squads that did investigations of radicals and suspected communist agitators. And then on the factory floors of industrial America, plant security also did counterintelligence work trying to ferret out the union organizers. So it was effectively kind of a privatized system of intelligence during the interwar period that operated. And Van Diemen was at the epicenter of that. He also served an informal function of moving classified reports from government files into the hand of citizen vigilantes. And it's believed that the New York Times, when they conducted an investigation in 1971 of Van Diemen and his network and his files, when they finally surfaced, it's believed that Van Diemen may have provided the allegations that Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas was a pinko, was a commie, and therefore at Nixon rallies when he ran against Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas for the U.S. Senate in 1950, Nixon disseminated the so-called pink sheets, tarring Helen Gehagen Douglas with the accusations of communism. It was believed that the Van Diemen files were the source of those allegations against her. But then in 1940, as war was starting, suddenly we began to expand both our foreign intelligence and our domestic counterintelligence. And in Washington, D.C., there was something called a closed-door delimitation conference in which U.S. Army intelligence and FBI met at the direction of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Van Diemen, although he was retired, attended there, and they divided the world. Basically, the North American, the Americas, North America and Latin America, became the purview of the FBI for counterintelligence, and the rest of the world became the purview of U.S. military intelligence, and then, of course, its successors, Office of Strategic Services, the CIA, and then the NSA. So that division of the world remained in effect until September 2011.
A couple of things struck me in the article, as you pointed out, that what we do abroad and the way we particularly began to go after people in the Philippines who were leading it away from the United States, and the surveillance we did then blew back on us. And throughout your whole piece, that's at least one of the key theories. And so now we come to 9/11 and, of course, the beginning of a massive surveillance state and George Bush and then Obama's role. So can you give us some sense of how that's set up and where we are today? And of course, when I looked at your piece, I said, well, there was a rollback each time after the worst of it. This time, there doesn't seem to be such a rollback. So let's talk about that.
The sophisticated surveillance apparatus comes home from the Philippines. It's developed in 1898-1907. It comes back in 1917. It elaborates into a massive counterintelligence surveillance apparatus across the United States, arguably the most intensive anywhere in the world to date. But then during the 1920s, it gets pulled back. Again, during the Vietnam eras, the combination of intelligence operations overseas in Vietnam and domestic counterintelligence produced is a proliferation of counterintelligence operations in the United States. Again, when the war is over in the late 1970s, 1978, through the investigation by Congress and the FISA reforms and internal bureaucratic reforms inside the CIA and FBI, it all gets cut back, just like it did in the 1920s, okay? Well, now we're seeing the same process, except with a difference, okay? After 9/11, the United States plunged into two complex wars, very similar to the way they did in 1898 in the Philippines. Iraqi and Afghan society are very dense, complex social formations. We plunged right into both. We had very limited, in fact, almost no intelligence on either society, no expertise, and we suddenly found ourselves facing massive insurgency, a Sunni insurgency in Iraq and a Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan, and the situation is blowing right out of control. You know, everybody thinks that the surge in 2007 under President Bush capped the situation, but that's apparently not the case. What happened was that, again, we had a kind of revolution in American intelligence, and we developed two fundamental techniques. First of all, under General McChrystal, the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, developed very sophisticated techniques for amassing all of the electronic and human intelligence on suspected al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorists, and then launched a very efficient operation under special operations forces and drones to assassinate, to systematically knock off these targets. And it's believed that, Woodward made the argument in his book on this period, on the surge, that it's really JSOC and the assassinations that turned the tide. Second thing that we did was we applied a very sophisticated digital identification, biometric identification techniques, starting the Battle of Fallujah, and then for the pacification of Baghdad. We compiled files of 3 million iris scans, retina scans, on Iraqis. These could be accessed by checkpoints and soldiers, U.S. soldiers on patrol.
That was an amazing fact to me when I read it, that you're going on a patrol, the soldier has a little handheld computer.
A camera with a wireless connection. And all you do is you reach forward and you just put your fingers, right, open up the eye and you take a shot. And this is it has to be a very high-quality digital camera. It turns out the iris has millions of unique biometric identifications encoded. And in 2000, a researcher at Cambridge University worked out a way of codifying the individual biometrics of every individual's iris. It's far more accurate and far easier to capture than a fingerprint.
Wow.
And these 3 million iris, retina, and fingerprints are housed in a mainframe computer in West Virginia. So the soldier could flick that digitally via satellite communication in West Virginia and get a confirmation. Is this Iraqi supposed to be on this street in this neighborhood? If not, take him in.
Amazing.
You can go online. You can Google. If you Google iris scan Afghanistan, you'll get hundreds, now thousands of photographs of U.S. soldiers, taking pictures of Afghani eyeballs, okay? And we've now got field teams in Afghanistan that do the same thing, although we're winding that back. So what we developed then was this very efficient system of surveillance and digital monitoring overseas. During the war on terror, we now know that the Bush administration, beginning in October 2001, authorized the NSA to start massive tapping of all digital communications, initially under the pretext of searching for foreigners, but gradually that barrier was thrown out, and we just began this massive data mining in collaboration with the British intelligence and indeed with the Five Eyes network that includes Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States. And in March of this year, it was 97 billion emails that were tapped by the NSA. This began migrating homeward very, very quickly through the NSA wiretapping of all fiber optic cables that are transmitting this data internationally in the United States. But the difference in the past, okay, is that the old partisan check on the establishment of a standing permanent surveillance state broke down. In other words, Bush did this, and we know that he did it illegally. Okay, the New York Times in 2005 had an amazing expose of Bush's illegal wiretapping. But when Obama came in, even though he criticized this illegal wiretapping as a senator and as a candidate, when he came in, instead of cutting it back as the Republicans had done in the 1920s and as the Democrats did in the 1970s, he's decided to build upon it. And what he's building upon it for, I think, is to build an architecture for the exercise of global power through a significant edge or advantage in information control and information warfare.
Al, I want you to stay on that for a second, because I thought that was one of the most important lines you wrote in the article and that you just said. And say that again, and then you talk about a 14% cutback in U.S. troops,
oh, yeah,
and you put the two together.
Sure. Obama in his 2012 budget cut back the infantry by 14%. He's cutting back all the conventional forces. He wants to cut back on the appropriations for the big BMS, the massive artillery, the heavy tanks, the big ships, and all that. And he wants to shift us into an agile form of information warfare and global information control. So what we've seen, for example, is at the same time that you're being cut back, the National Security Administration is spending $1.6 billion to build the world's biggest data farm in Bluffdale, Utah. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency has a nearly $2 billion headquarters with 16,000 employees recently established in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration has launched a new generation of light, low-cost, very agile satellites that are now actually can be remotely controlled from the ground and are serving ground force commanders in Central Command in Afghanistan, allowing them to use satellites for on-ground intelligence. The Obama administration is also building an armada of 99 Global Hawk drones with 24-hour flight capacity. And these aren't drones for, you know, firing missiles like the Reaper and the Predator. These are basically surveillance drones that have a 100-mile ambit for sucking up audio communications. And so I think what we're looking at is, okay, you got the NSA in collaboration with British intelligence, British signals intelligence, GCHQ, tapping the world's fiber optic cables. And as I said in March, 97 billion messages intercepted. At the same time, we're launching this fleet of Global Hawk drones that can get all those localized two-way communications that are radio transmitted that are not necessarily going to hit the global fiber optic networks. And the combination of the drone surveillance, and mind you, there's a network of about 50 bases ringing the Eurasian landmass to launch these drones. So the combination of drones sucking up the localized two-way radio or cell phone communications in localized systems with the tapping of the fiber optic cables within the United States by the NSA and then internationally by allies in the Five Eyes coalition, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, means that the NSA will have virtually a total global surveillance system for the first time in human history. It's an extraordinary moment, and the power that that potentially gives the United States for the perpetuation of global hegemony is really quite extraordinary.
How do we have the capacity to effectively analyze and use this kind of level of surveillance and data?
Well, we're getting into an area we don't know very much about, because this is, you know, if there's anything that's secret, it's this sort of stuff. But in 2006, the Bush administration launched a project to harness the IBM Watson series of supercomputers, okay, and apply them to the task of crunching this data.
Where do we tell listeners to get your article? What's the website?
The website, the article is out. It's called Surveillance Blowback, and it's on Tom Dispatch, which if you just type in Tom Dispatch, you'll get, and my name, you'll get the article. And second, my book's name is Policing America's Empire, and it's published by University of Wisconsin Press. The subtitle is The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State.
Well, thank you, Professor Al McCoy. You always have actually almost the only really new and amazingly prescient look at what's going on in this country and abroad. So thank you.
Thank
Michael,
you.
Wonderful talking. Heidi, wonderful talking.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.